Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America here on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Good Sunday evening for April 21st, 2024. Or if you're listening live on the East Coast, it's Monday, April 22nd, 2024. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, and we are coming to you live after AEW Dynasty, and a lot to talk about, a lot to unpack from this show, and I'll get right into it by welcoming my co-host for the evening, my co-host for each and every pay-per-view post-show WWE and AEW that we have here on Wrestling Night in America, PWTorch.com contributor Brandon LeClaire. Brandon, thanks for hopping on again with me here to talk Dynasty.
Glad to be here.
So, Brandon, you could start a lot of different places here on this show. Swerve Strickland in the main event, winning the AEW championship, first African-American to hold that title. The Will Ospreay-Brian Danielson match that will probably go down as one of the best matches that I've ever seen. Not probably, definitely. And, you know, there's a couple other points here that we could talk about. Jack Perry's return in the semi-main event. What's your top-level takeaway of those, or maybe something I didn't mention, coming out of Dynasty tonight?
I think you have to start with the Will Ospreay-Brian Danielson match, just the sheer quality of it, the atmosphere for it, which I think while the Joe and Swerve Strickland main event kind of got close in terms of atmosphere, it never really got to the levels that Ospreay and Danielson did. I am obviously very, very high on the match itself, less so about the injury angle, but we'll get into that, I'm sure.
Right. I was kind of torn on the injury angle at the end. It seems par for the course for Brian Danielson matches these days, playing on the fears that fans have about Brian Danielson at this stage of his career, knowing his injury history. But I do think there's something deeper than that here with Will Ospreay and Don Callis. You know, Callis on commentary was not always 100% complimentary toward Will Ospreay. So you could see where Ospreay showing remorse for Brian Danielson and showing compassion for him after the match could be something that drives a wedge between him and Don Callis. You know, that with the reaction that Ospreay is getting from the crowd, it is a discussion point amongst fans where it feels like it's only a matter of time before Ospreay splits away from Callis. They did sort of tease that with Callis on commentary. Does framing it that way make it any more palatable to run this post-match injury angle that they did with Danielson?
I think it probably does for some people, but not for me. I think at this point, I spend so much of my time watching Brian Danielson hoping that he doesn't go a step too far and end up in a wheelchair. And I know that that is, you know, some people are just absolutely fine with the injury angle, and I get that Brian likes to toe that line. It's just not something that I want to see, especially with this frequency in pro wrestling, and especially from someone with the level of history with severe career life-altering injuries that Brian Danielson has had. I think that they have been doing a good enough job without the injury angle to tease the obvious pending breakup between Ospreay and the Don Callis family. I mean, they played into it on Dynamite this past Wednesday. It was very clear throughout the course of the match that Ospreay and Danielson were respectful opponents, despite, you know, Ospreay's association with the Callis family. And I just could have done without it. I think that, you know, you've already had an instant classic of a match, and you can do the match exactly as you did it without that moment. I think that it was really short-sighted. I think that asking the fans to fully embrace Ospreay's win while you have Danielson on the mat writhing in pain and having doctors rush into the ring like that is short-sighted. I think it's a tough ask for the crowd. I think the crowd was taken out of the next match as a result. I just think it's poor booking. It's just poor storytelling, and it's unnecessary.
Well, we'll get into some of the other big moments and matches here on Wrestling Night America for AEW Dynasty. Before we get into our phone calls, and don't forget you can join us, 515-605-9345 is the number to call. If you'd like to participate and share your thoughts about Dynasty, you can. You can press 1 on your keypad if you're listening live. And you can also email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com. is where you can send your emails. We'll get to those throughout the show as well for those that come in. We're also scheduled to have an on-site correspondent for the show. We'll be looking forward to him calling in. But, Brandon, just kind of overall big picture on this show, with the Danielson-Ospreay match, with some of the other matches up and down the card, it does feel like AEW has put together now two really, really good pay-per-views in a row. Is that kind of your feeling coming out of this as well, quality-wise?
Oh, for sure, yeah. I mean, a huge rebound coming off of last year's two kind of back-to-back disappointments. I think they certainly came out of the gates this year swinging with Revolution, which I thought was, as I said on the show, the best show in company history, and tonight I thought was excellent as well.
All right, well, let us kick things off here on the phones with the 615 area code. Sean from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, is going to lead us off here on the Dynasty Post Show. Sean, thank you for calling in tonight as usual, and what did you think of Dynasty tonight?
Oh, my gosh, guys. So many thoughts. I would not say excellent for the show. I disagree. I have a lot. I want to say a lot, but I'll try to fit in as much as I can, you know, with going quick. I want to go to Ospreay Danielson, like you guys just said. I hated that finish. I hated it. I'm sorry. Like, you could have a 7 billion-star match, and there's no need for that effing finish. It was stupid. You had already done that with, you know, the dissension with Callis. And I'm an Ospreay, you know, some of the no-selling he does, which he actually sold really well tonight, which I really enjoyed. And it was just, they get in their own way. Tony Khan gets in his own way by booking these terrible finishes. And it's Danielson who, like you said, Brandon, you put it really well. Like, we already worry for him in a lot of ways anyway. And now we have to, and then what to me makes it worse is when you have an injury like that, where the stretcher would come out, and then you're going to a match right away, and, like, he's out of the ring that quick? Like, you got to turn your brain off. Like, it's like, come on, guys. Like, you got to do better than this. Like, the match itself was a phenomenal match. It was absolutely phenomenal, and I can't get over the bad finish. I mean, I can't get over it. It was just awful, and that took the show down for me a lot, actually. But I wanted to say, too,
Sean,
but,
clarify. Yeah. Before you continue, when you say the finish, are you referring to the actual sequence of events that led to the finish, or are you just referring to the injury spot?
I think it's more the injury spot, because, like, when because they were playing into, you know, of course, like, Ospreay doesn't see what's going on. He just sees
right. He's
in his own mind. He's fired up. He's ready to go. He doesn't see. So I didn't, like, think Ospreay was being bad or heelish by what he was doing. He just was in his mind and was not paying attention because he didn't realize he was just in his own fat part of it and the callous stuff, but just the injury angle was just terrible. It was just terrible. But I want to get off that because you guys talked about that a lot. I wanted to talk about something else real quick. I want to talk about the fact that there were just a lot of matches on this show that really didn't need to be on the show. I mean, they just really didn't. You know, Roderick Strong, Kyle O'Reilly, you know, put on it was a fine match, but we just didn't need that on this pay-per-view. It could have been on a Dynamite or a Collision, and you have Kyle O'Reilly lose, which he was going to because they didn't build him up really enough to win the match. And that hurts the show, like a show like this for me, because I'm not really investing in the match because I know Roderick Strong's going to win. He's not going to lose the match. And it's just kind of, it's like, whatever. But the other thing I wanted to ask your actual both of your opinions on was the Tony Storm Thunder Rosa match. I just, again, you know, the match was actually better than I was expecting, but the crowd doesn't, they want to cheer Tony Storm. They like Tony Storm, and she's supposed to be a heel, and I just don't like this character Tony's playing as much as I'm enjoying it. And where do you think they go from here? Because I don't know where Tony goes right now. The fans want to cheer, and they want you to boo her with the low blow and the refs looking like idiots. And I just – there was a lot of that match I didn't like. So what did you think of the match, the finish, and where do you think Tony goes from here?
Sean, I got disconnected there briefly. I got the last part of it, but what match are you asking about? Yeah, I mean, I thought that was a really good match. This may be a – product of low expectations, but I thought that was a pretty strong match. At least, you know, again, low expectations, the Tony Storm matches that she's had. And with that character, I think there have been some issues bell to bell with it. I think we've chronicled that pretty extensively here on Wrestling Night in America. So it just felt like a different style of Tony Storm in that match, which I think was sorely needed. And I think Thunder Rosa brought a little bit of a different style out of her, which was good. Brandon, what did you think of the finish and the match?
Yeah, I liked the match. I thought that, Greg, like you said, it was a bit of a different avenue for this Tony Storm character to go down, and I thought that was good because too many of her matches and title defenses end up, I think, over-relying on the comedic hokey shtick a little bit too much. I mean, they only cut to black and white once here, which was a pretty big positive, if you ask me. Thunder Rosa was a good foil. She was never going to win the championship, but I thought she was a good challenger for this particular pay-per-view. Generally speaking, Sean, I'm with you in that I really enjoy the Tony Storm character in a vacuum because I like seeing good wrestlers and good character actors portray entertaining characters. But I also acknowledge that it's not particularly conducive to being a serious world champion. I look at it a lot like I looked at the MJF and Adam Cole stuff from last summer when they were doing the buddy comedy shtick, and it was hilarious and entertaining, and I liked it very much. But in the same breath, I would have to acknowledge that it probably wasn't good for two main event talents and one being the World Heavyweight Champion to be partaking in buddy action comedy stuff. And I think that this Tony Storm character is much like that. So I feel like the title reign has in some ways run its course, though I don't really see a person on the horizon that makes a ton of sense to shift to, because you've got Mercedes Moné tied up in the TBS championship division. So it seems like they're continuing to run with Tony because she's over. And, I mean, it's hard to argue with that at face value because in the past, they've been very opt to just play hot potato with that women's title. And I think it's good that they're not doing that now. But it does leave you in this position where you kind of have these mid-card feeling feuds because – Tony's character is very mid-card.
It always feels like the story is going to come down to Mariah May and Tony Storm at some point, right? That kind of feels like what they're leading to with Mariah May eventually perhaps unseating Tony Storm for that championship. But, I mean, this is the slowest of slow burns of a storyline, and you know, the fear is this Tony, the interest in this Tony Storm character is going to peter out well before they get to the turn or, you know, whatever happens with Mariah May getting that title shot against Tony finally.
Yeah.
Sean, anything else for us tonight?
Yeah, and I'll say I was happy for Willow. I mean, in the sense of her winning the title. I mean, I'm excited for. I just don't know where they're going with this Willow Mercedes feud. I hope Mercedes turns heel really soon. I just don't like this face character of hers right now at all. I'm not a fan. I don't know where it's going. I hope it's going somewhere good, but I'm waiting to see. Two more quick things. The first was going to the tag team title match in the ladder match. I mean, I thought for what it was really fun that they worked their butts off. They, you know, had a lot of crazy spots like you were going to expect. And, you know, you had the obvious finish with Jack Perry coming in to, you know, help them win and then them carrying them off, which was kind of cool. Even though we knew what was coming, you know, you knew the Bucks were going to probably win. You know, I told you, Greg, and that's why I wanted Brandon to talk about this too, is I just don't know. The tag team division just doesn't have a lot of depth to it right now, and I think they've really got to figure that out. Like right now, they're okay with the Bucks having it, but they've got to get some tag teams go against them. And right now, I just don't feel like they have a lot of them right now. A lot of them are either cold or they've lost like a ton on TV. So what did you think of the match, and then where do you think the Bucks go from here? Because I don't know the teams that they really have in line for title shots here anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really good match, very intense, very hard-hitting. They certainly didn't take it easy because they followed Ospreay versus Danielson. In fact, I posted this online at Greg M. Parks on Twitter. You know, I feel like the Bucks and FTR are two teams who would welcome the opportunity to follow Ospreay versus Danielson. They would welcome that challenge. And, you know, they could have rested on their laurels and got by on their name value and put together a good match and not taken too many risks because, you know, the crowd was tired, and they were for the first part of it, but they worked so hard in getting the crowd back into it that they succeeded. And so the risks they took in a way paid off. But yeah, it does make you wonder in terms of the tag division, Brandon, where we go from here. The Young Bucks knocking off FTR. You've got Jack Perry coming back. He's going to be aligned with the Young Bucks, but you've got to have some teams there that are up to par with the Young Bucks. And the Bucks with these characters have been portrayed as sort of above and beyond a lot of the other teams in the division, that it's a real struggle to come up with two or three teams that they could face over the course of, you know, 2 or 3 months defending these tag titles.
Yeah, I thought that how hard these two teams worked to try to overcome the spot they were in, I thought it was lost on the fact that this was just a nearly impossible run of just like breakneck pace between Danielson and Ospreay, and then this match and then the main event. I know that AEW sort of likes to build to their crescendo, but man, in a situation like this, I think that they would have been better served spacing these matches out and maybe opening the show I thought that the Pac and Okada opening the show was good, but I would have spaced these three matches out somehow. At least get something else in between Danielson and Ospreay and your world title match, because the crowd was trying to recover from the Ospreay and Danielson match. And also coming down from that injury angle and seeing Danielson the way that they saw him. And then you're asking them to, within minutes, I mean, just a video package length of time, get immediately back into this blood feud between FTR and the Young Bucks. And it took them probably more than half the match to kind of come around. And I can't blame them for that. It sort of took me that long, too. This is a match that I thought was very good, but that I want to go back and watch again by itself without its bookends, because I think it'll fare much better under that light. As for the tag division itself, I mean, yeah, that was once a really strong point of AEW's roster. They had a really impressive tag division and a really impressive run where tag title matches were regularly stealing shows. And for quite a long time now, those titles have felt like they were secondary and sometimes even tertiary to, you know, the ROH tag titles when Adam Cole and MJF had them. And then the trios titles, which thankfully tonight were merged during Zero Hour. I would get rid of the trios belts altogether because I think that takes some tag teams out of your primary division. But we know that that's not AEW's MO. I mean, they like a lot of titles. So, yeah, I think that there's room for improvement, absolutely, in that tag division. I don't know if we're going to see it.
I don't know how to word this, but the idea of them showing and getting the backlash from the CM Punk Jack Perry altercation, even when it was revealed what it was building to, I think people still didn't like the idea of that being shown on television.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if people like it even less because it was used to further a match that ultimately kind of gets lost in the aftermath of the Ospreay Danielson match. Like if the Bucks and FTR had main evented this show, partly on the back of the emotion stemming from showing the Punk Jack Perry backstage footage, I think you could at least make the argument that it may have been somewhat worth it in some kind of twisted logic because it was being used to build up a main event pay-per-view program. But having it shown and then having the Bucks and FTR in a, as you mentioned, Brandon, like half of the match heatless because of Danielson versus Ospreay, I just wonder if that makes it seem like an even worse decision to use that for this match in hindsight. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, and I think you're right. It felt empty. It just felt kind of hollow, and I think that, you know, based on what we saw this week on Dynamite, there, Tony will never admit, and he said publicly that, you know, he stands by the decision, but I think that actions speak louder than words, and their actions on Dynamite more or less confirm that they regret it. I mean, there was no mention made of it. They moved on. This week's Dynamite was essentially the antithesis of the previous week's Dynamite. It's like they got the feedback and they said, okay, we screwed up, back to the drawing board. And I thought that this week's Dynamite was a much better show leading into a very good night on pay-per-view, and zero mention made of this, you know, kind of stain that I think that was a poor decision from the get-go, and you're already seeing sort of the fallout and the things that can become of it. I mean, tonight you heard EVP chants and Jack Perry got a positive reaction, and if that continues, I mean, you sort of have to pivot and figure out how this is going to work, because they're going to have a problem if Jack Perry is supposed to be a heel and he is, in story, the scapegoat, then technically that also sort of makes Tony Khan a heel, and it also means that whatever babyface is going to stand against Jack Perry is, by proxy, defending CM Punk, who is in the other company. It's a convoluted mess, and to even have entered that into the realm of your week-to-week storytelling was a huge mistake.
Yeah, it's now become storyline canon for this story. So I think that's the frustration. Sean, any closing comments for us tonight before we let you go?
Yeah, just real quick thing. I'm very, you know, very, very – the ending of the show was really good. That helped me a little bit more knowing Swerve did win the title. I'm definitely excited for him. I've been a fan. My only worry is, And I know some people don't think it is, but my only worry is that he's going to have just a short title reign and Ospreay's going to beat him at All In. And I just think that's going to be kind of a – I'm not going to say it's a waste because it's Swerve and I like what he's doing, but if you're going to win the title, I just feel like having it for a few months, it's good while it lasts, but then how good really is it? So I'm kind of worried about that. But I want to hear what you guys thought about the match, and I appreciate you guys taking my call. I know it's late. I hope you guys have a good show, and thanks as always.
All right. Thank you, Sean. Appreciate it. Yeah, the main event, I mean, it feels like it got overshadowed. You know, certainly not Swerve's win. I think that's a big deal. It was treated like a big deal. It should be. But the match itself, I think, is going to get lost to history in a way, you know, with Danielson versus Ospreay, with the Bucks and FTR, and just the hardcore nature of that ladder match. And then, strangely enough, Hook versus Chris Jericho and the crowd reactions there. I mean, these are just some of the matches on this night. And, you know, maybe even Toni Storm versus Thunder Rosa, just because of how much of a departure it was from Toni Storm's matches with this character. So I do think it really has, unfortunately, the likelihood of sort of being lost in the shuffle. But I don't think Swerve's win is going to get lost. I think that is going to be something that stands out. It's one of the things, Brandon, that I brought up to you at the top of the show in terms of talking points coming out of this. But the match itself, while pretty good, I mean, it was unremarkable in comparison to some of the other matches on the show.
Yeah, kudos to AEW here for really lingering on the aftermath, on Swerve's victory, because we've seen this company do the opposite before. I mean, they have on many occasions faded to black just seconds after the final bell, when they're up against the clock. We've seen them skirt by really serious situations and move on to the next match. I mean, we saw it literally on this show with Danielson and Ospreay, because they're trying to keep such tight time cues, and there's so much packed into these four-hour shows. And I've been very critical of them for that, because I think it takes away from moments and from stories, and it makes everything feel like it's a running track that never slows down and never takes an opportunity to acknowledge the breadth and the seriousness of moments. And that's something where you have these two major companies in AEW and WWE. I feel like WWE sometimes goes overboard in their slowing down mm-hmm. for the moments. And AEW never slows down enough. It's like there's no happy medium. And they did it for Swerve tonight. And that was a big deal. Because I think if you had Swerve hit the Swerve stomp, get the three, and we see, I don't know, 30 seconds of him celebrating with the title before they fade to black, that's going to feel unbecoming of a major championship change. And it's very easy at that point to feel like his win and the gravity of his win as being the first African-American AEW champion would be lost to the commotion and calamity and insanity of what came before it, particularly Ospreay and Danielson. So to have hung back with it for so long, I think, was the right move and saved it from becoming something that gets lost to just the craziness of the rest of the show. I thought the match was really good. Joe in particular, I thought just his facials in the early going, the way that he was just sort of brushing off Swerve's offense was great. They told a different story rather than, you know, going in at each other for 30 plus minutes the way that Hangman and Swerve had, or the way that the three of them did at Revolution. I thought that they slowed down the pace to an appropriate level. Joe looked dominant. I love the spot near the beginning of the match where Joe tried to move out of the way and Swerve landed on his feet. They both telegraphed each other. Mm-hmm. That was a great way to really kick things off. I just thought that the major beats of the match were laid out really well. It was a very, very strong Samoa Joe main event. But with all that being said, I mean, it shares the card with Bryan Danielson versus Will Ospreay. So it's going to be hard for it to stand the test of time with that.
I mentioned earlier that we had a live correspondent calling in. Grant is waiting patiently on the line, so let's go to him next. Grant there in St. Louis. Grant, welcome to Wrestling Night in America. Thank you so much for volunteering and reaching out to be the live correspondent tonight.
Oh, no problem. No problem. I spoke with Wade like last week when SmackDown was in Detroit, and I was told him, I'm like, I'll be in town for Dynasty. So, I was told him I'd give you a call.
Excellent. So, first of all, what did you think of the show live quality-wise? You know, was it a really good show? Was it a good show? Was it somewhere in between? What did you think of it overall?
I think overall it was a really good show to great, to be honest with you. I don't really, only say maybe one match that didn't, like, just wow me. Other than that, everything else was pretty good.
Did that seem to be the general consensus of the fans that you talked to or were around?
Yeah, pretty much everybody I spoke with and everybody that was in my section. It was just the only disappointing thing was Jericho Hook, and the people actually got into it towards the end. So that even wasn't like terrible.
Yeah. Well, let's start there because that was perhaps the most interesting crowd reaction of the evening, that Jericho versus Hook match. It sounded like the crowd was kind of dogging on Jericho. Was there a playfulness there, or were people just really not interested in seeing Chris Jericho, or was it, you know, some fans started this chant and other fans joined in, maybe not knowing what was going on? I mean, how did you sense that chant and the reaction to Jericho?
So the reaction to Jericho, it wasn't like when the match first started. That's when a lot of people took their bath from break. Like people were not interested. You know, like a lot of people just was over Jericho. Then you heard it was one particular, like it was like two guys. They started the chant, and then I'm not sure if everybody even, you know, knew what was going on and just wanted to join in.
Right.
And then it just picked up from there. It definitely started off with disinterest. But, like, towards the end of the match, people did start getting into it, though. So, I mean, they kind of got people back, especially once Taz got up from his seat. People definitely thought he was actually going to get involved. So that was that kind of helped the reaction. But, not a whole lot of interest in it, in Jericho for sure. So that's where you got those chants from. Yeah.
What was it like being in the crowd live for Will Ospreay versus Brian Danielson? Was there, you know, obviously there was the Fight Forever chants. Yeah. There was the, you know, all the chants for these guys during the match. But was there a real sense as the match was happening, was there kind of a buzz in the crowd that, hey, you know, this is really something special that we're seeing right here?
Yeah, you got a lot of, I mean, they got a standing ovation before and after. You got a chant I never heard before, and the we're not worthy. I never heard that. it was like an anime fight. It just seemed unreal, and I think everybody kind of felt that in the building. I don't know if it came across on camera, but definitely in the building, it was electric. And like I went there specifically to see Swerve win the belt, but I can say I've never felt the energy in the building change like it does when Will Ospreay comes out. But it gives Stone Cold 97. Like, it's unreal. Wow.
Yeah, that pop came across on TV when he came out, for sure. Absolutely. Brandon, anything you want to ask Grant here while we've got him on the line?
Yeah, talk a little bit about the
end of the match there with Swerve and Danielson. What happened with Danielson after they not went off the air but went to the video package? They told us on commentary that he walked to the back with trainers. Was there concern from the crowd? Did you sense that like they were pretty, that they had a pretty good idea that it was an angle, or was there any uneasiness? What was it like?
I think people were a little confused because even myself, I thought he might have really got hurt because even like they were acting like they didn't want to move him. Even after they went to the video package, they just scooted him out the ring. Like they didn't, like normally, you know, they would help somebody up and help them through the ropes. Like they, it was none of that. They treated him as if like he broke his collarbone. So like I'm pretty sure everybody didn't pick up on it being a work, or you know, it was probably a little bit confusing. I know people in my section for sure. I was like right behind the announcer's desk, probably like fourth row, so that first row off the ground. But yeah, it was definitely a well worked. If it's not a actual injury.
Grant, how would you do? Well, the first two questions here. First, what was the attendance like? Was it packed, full? Were there empty seats? What did that look like to you in terms of maybe percentage of sellout? And then from being there in the audience, what was your sense of how hot the crowd was? Was this a crowd that was hot all night? Were there lulls? What was it like being in the building in terms of the crowd reaction?
So it was probably, for the piece that they made available, I want to say they probably had 90% sell through. Like, you know, it was some empties, but they were kind of sparse and a few between. As far as just how the crowd, just being in the crowd, yeah, they were pretty hot, but pretty much start to finish. Like I said, the lulls came maybe the beginning of the Jericho match and maybe during the House of Black match. That was probably about it, though. It was pretty hot pretty much all the way through.
Did it take a while for the crowd to get into the Young Bucks FTR match after Ospreay Danielson? Did you get a sense the crowd was tired from that Ospreay Danielson match and the Young Bucks and FTR had to work to get them back into the match, or from being there live, was the crowd into it basically from the beginning?
I'll say like at the very beginning, like FTR kind of had to, you know, get people back into it, like just you know, pumping up the crowd, waving towards them to get up. But after that, they were pretty much into it from there. So it wasn't too much burnout from Danielson and Ospreay. But yeah, they were probably into it, maybe 85% of the match they were into it. Just that very beginning, it was people trying to, you know, catch their breath a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Brandon, anything else for Grant?
Yeah, you said the primary reason that you had gone was to see Swerve win the AEW championship. What was that moment like for the crowd?
It was like pandemonium. Like you could see a lot of Swerve's friends, and,
mm-hmm.
You know, collaborators on music and whatnot. Like the people that he has, you know, been on his podcast, and I mean, some of them appeared on AEW with him. So it's a lot of that. And you've seen, I don't know if it was still on camera, he gave like West Side Gun a hug and. It was a full celebration. So even though that Ospreay Danielson match was probably the most over thing on the show, the Swerve for sure was still the most over babyface. Like I don't know if you all heard it on camera, but it was Swerve's house's chant the entire main event, from start to finish. So he was that. So like I don't know if it's just because he was getting crowned or what, but you definitely got feeling like, okay, Swerve is the number one babyface, even with, you know, what was going on with Ospreay and Danielson.
So you'd say he was a bigger babyface than Ospreay?
Yes, I could say that for sure. Like I said, I don't know if it's just for one night or what, mm-hmm. but yeah, definitely for sure he was.
So they were probably the top two babyfaces on the show in terms of reaction. Who were some of the top heels? You know, Jericho obviously got a heel reaction, but was there anyone else who stood out to you in terms of getting a strong heel reaction from the crowd?
Heel reaction. Who else would have been? It was definitely Jericho would have been one. People were into Joe. Reaction. People were really into a majority of the people on this card. I'm trying to think who actually got a heel reaction besides Jericho. because even Jack Perry got a face reaction. You got Adam Cole probably got the third biggest pop on the show once he got out his wheelchair. I'm trying to think who actually got a. It probably was just Jericho, to be honest with you. That crowd was pretty into everybody.
Interesting. Yeah. Was there anything else that maybe happened off television or that you think may have happened off television that's worth pointing out to those who were watching on TV that maybe they didn't see?
I'm not going to say about it. I was trying to write some stuff down. Oh, no, you know who did? It just clicked. Okada got, after when he didn't give people the Rainmaker pose and he gave everybody the finger.
Oh, yeah.
That probably got the biggest heel reaction of the night. And he got booze from there. So I would say Jericho won Okada too, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brandon, anything else for Grant before we let him go get home for the evening?
No, I don't think so.
I'm not.
Grant, I really appreciate it.
I'm on my way to the airport, so I got time.
Oh, cool. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to call us in, and glad you had a good time. Thank you so much for emailing and letting us know you're available to talk tonight.
No problem. If you got anything else you think of, just shoot me an email. I'll probably be listening to the end of the show.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
No problem.
Brandon, I want to pick at something that Grant said that kind of got me off on a tangent in my own mind, I think. And that's the fact that so few people got heel reactions on this show.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Is that something that, I think there is a large percentage of AEW fans who are fans of AEW and fans of the wrestlers in AEW, and they just, they cheer for the brand. And if you're under the brand's umbrella, you are liked by those fans. Is it problematic for AEW, do you think, that they don't have anyone to really garner that heel heat? I go back to what CM Punk said in his Ariel Helwani interview, that he doesn't really know how AEW wants to make money. Like, he doesn't know what the business plan is, because for so long, professional wrestling has been predicated on heels that people want to see get beat up or get their comeuppance, and people will shell out money to do that. And if you don't have a heel in your company that people want to see get beat up or want to see the babyface overcome, there's no Roman Reigns in AEW. There's no heels that people. So I wonder if that's problematic, or can AEW survive with just the goodwill that they have built up amongst their fans, who are just going to be willing to shell out $50 every month or two to watch a good show?
Well, it's been sort of the, everything is sort of tongue in cheek you know, they hate the Young Bucks, but they don't really hate the Young Bucks. They just, you know, they boo them because it's the characters. It's everything is meta to a certain extent, and it's been a valid criticism of AEW since day one. And I think they've leaned rather than hone in on their particular, you know, their proclivities. I think they've leaned in more heavily on the idea that good wrestling is good wrestling, and that will get them by. I mean, it's hard to argue when they are maintaining relatively steady ratings for their position. I mean, if they're happy with those numbers, then it looks like they can probably keep them up. The pay-per-views seem to do solid buys. Attendance is a real problem. They don't tend to acknowledge that, but it is. The simple fact is AEW is going to exist for as long as Tony Khan wants it to exist. Because it's a much different scenario than something like WCW, for example. I mean, do I think it's a good long-term business strategy to not build heels who you want to see get their comeuppance? No, definitely not. I mean, I think it... I think you've seen a certain level, a new water level for AEW since they've leaned so heavily into the style that they're now producing. But they seem content with it. I mean, they don't seem to want to change. Their fans, or their most diehard fans, don't seem to want them to change in any way. So I think this is par for the course. I don't think you're going to see any true heels.
I think this debate is personified by Bryan Danielson and his heel character, where it's like, yeah, he's a heel, but no one's going to boo him. People love him. And it's almost as if he's doing it like with a wink and a nod, you know,
right.
I'm a heel, but you know, that's sort of like what AEW is about now. And I do wonder, because I think, you know, there's some worry warts out there about this, but I think AEW is going to be due for a pretty hefty rights fee increase when all is said and done. And you do wonder if, because there are valid criticisms of AEW's way of doing things, and I think this is one of them. I think Punk brought up some of them in his interview that are likely to fall on deaf ears within AEW because of who he is and things like that. But you wonder if Tony Khan is going to see the rights fee increase as validation that what he's doing is the correct way of doing things. And all of this criticism is unfair, or it's from WWE fanboys, or it's just, you know, whatever excuse that, you know, we've gotten on WWE for making about criticisms that people have had of the booking throughout the years. You know, it kind of reminds me of that Triple H comment, you know, how's your territory doing? When that was kind of the deflection of criticism that people from the outside had. And, you know, if Tony Khan gets this rights fee increase that he's expecting, and that I think a lot of people who have an eye on the business are expecting, you know, is he going to use that kind of, I won't say he's going to say the exact same thing, but, you know, is that going to be a shield for him to address any kind of other serious criticisms of the product? That's kind of my fear.
I think it absolutely will be. I mean, we've seen that kind of behavior before. I mean, he will typically point to the number of pay-per-view buys or whatever. I mean, whenever it's an easy deflection whenever somebody talks about the attendance figures or anything like that. I mean, he points to being number three on cable or only behind the NBA or the buys of the most recent pay-per-view year over year increases in buys. I mean, I think AEW has enough successes where they will be perfectly content to exist in their echo chamber and ignore the small things that could undoubtedly make a big difference in their product.
Let's go to the next phone call. It's the 773 area code. This is Boris from Chicago. Boris, welcome to Wrestling Night in America tonight. What do you think of Dynasty? Boris. You know, I was going to make a joke, but I thought I'd give Boris an opportunity to surprise me here that he was either awake or paying attention. But we'll put him on hold and we'll come back to him because we've got an email from JB. It's not too late, guys. If you want to call in 515-605-9345, make sure to press 1 to show up that you want to comment on Dynasty tonight. You can email us at wnialivecast@gmail.com. So JB from Detroit has an email with some thoughts on the show. He says, now that the Trios titles were finally unified on the zero-hour show, I'm hoping that the Bang Bang Gang come back with a new belt design rather than carrying around two sets of titles. He says, I like the new technique AEW has been utilizing with Renee acting as a sideline reporter between entrances, much like they do at the halftime of an NFL game. I noticed that early on in the show. I think it was right before Okada and Pac in the opening match, and I thought that was a nice touch. It's just something small to differentiate yourself production-wise from WWE, and it's a step in the right direction because we've seen AEW seemingly take steps back in production. I know the episode that I covered of Dynamite for Wade Keller when he was unable to cover Dynamite a couple weeks ago, the famous CM Punk video episode. I had the good luck, good fortune of being able to step in and cover that show in real time in written form on PWTorch.com. And, you know, they started with the camera zooming during interviews. And I'm like, no, this was the number one production criticism of WWE for years. Why would you start doing this? And so anything even small like this, I think, is a positive sign. Any way you can differentiate yourself from the competition, I think, is a good sign. So I approve of that.
Yeah, I thought it was good. They've done this a couple times before. I think it's a good addition overall. Adds to the real sports feel, which WWE has been leaning heavily into. I think that anytime you have the opportunity to try new things in terms of camera angles and production, just to add a little spice and a little value to your presentation, it's a net positive. And the worst thing that happens is it's not good, and then you just don't do it again. So this was good, and I hope they continue to do it and make the best use of Renee because she's awesome.
Back to JB's email. He says, Okada is being treated very much as a face. Do you see this being a problem with getting the new elite booed and keeping them as heels? Well, I'd say not so much after the middle finger there that he gave during the match. He seems to be embracing the heel persona. But I do think this goes back to something that was said about Mercedes Moné and, you know, why she's a babyface and not a heel. I understand AEW wanting to introduce her as a babyface because, look, she's going to get a babyface pop, right? She's a big enough star. She's well-liked by enough fans where when you introduce her, she's going to be a babyface. So why try to go against the grain at first? That's why I'm kind of okay with them. If the direction is for her to eventually go heel against Willow Nightingale, I'm fine with it. Introduce her as a babyface. Let her get some crowd pops until, you know, she's used to being seen on TV. And then I think the fans would be more willing to accept her as a heel when she's not the new, fresh thing that they want to cheer. So I didn't necessarily think they needed to bring her in as a heel, but I do think that has to be the direction sooner rather than later, probably.
I don't think it's worth fighting an uphill battle. You create so much unnecessary headwind when you have characters misaligned, and AEW has been getting themselves into that position a lot more often lately than they used to and really than they should. But I think that goes back to them just not really caring because they think at the end of the day the fans are just going to cheer for good wrestling and it doesn't really matter what the designation of a wrestler is. I think that's why you see guys like the Blackpool Combat Club turn ad nauseum and literally at times from match to match because they just think that, you know, being tweeners is fine when evidence suggests it's just not something that works in 2024 pro wrestling. We used to harp on WWE for fighting, you know, uphill battles all the time with their characters' designations, and they largely have it right now. And AEW is going through a spat of getting things wrong in that department. And I think that the tide is probably fairly likely to turn on Mercedes pretty quickly. Number one, because I think that having Mercedes juxtaposed to Willow Nightingale has done more damage than good to Mercedes. I said this on the post show with Wade on Wednesday after Dynamite. Willow has become such a beacon of light in that women's division, and I liken her rise to that of Becky Lynch. She is someone who was not brought onto the shows with any real expectations. She was kind of an undercard bit player. She lost a whole lot, wasn't part of any central storylines, grew in confidence, had really good matches, and just over time organically connected with the crowd, delivered strong promos, and got to a point where she was undeniable, as Cody Rhodes likes to often refer to himself as. It's a very similar story to Becky Lynch, and I think that Willow has really slid into that role very, very nicely, and the organic connection she has with the crowd and her ability to believe to deliver natural babyface promos juxtaposed with Mercedes' very rehearsed fake-sounding promos have done harm to her. And I think before too long, Monet is going to be exposed to some extent. And I think that the crowd is going to sense that. So I don't think that it's a bad idea to lean into her heel proclivities. She's a better heel than she is a babyface and always has been. I think Mercedes' best is – I think that the Sasha Banks character was always best when she was a cool heel who you kind of wanted to cheer for, but she was just dastardly enough against good baby faces that you wouldn't, against, you know, the likes of Bayley, for example. And I think that's a good spot with Willow. I think that Mercedes acting dastardly and awful and nasty toward Willow, the crowd is much more likely to side with Willow. So, yeah, that's the natural designation, and I think it's the direction they need to go.
Back to JB's email. With Malakai Black getting the pin and win in the trios match, is he next in line for a shot at Adam Copeland's TNT title? That certainly would seem to me to be the direction they're going there.
I hope so. I mean, I've been a huge proponent of Malakai Black. I know that there's a lot of discontent among a lot of AEW faithful with him. And I have often wondered myself what they're doing with him and what the reason for his stop-start pushes are. But if he's found an in with Adam Copeland and they like working with each other, then that's fine by me. I have often said that there are few wrestlers that I watch that make things look more effortless than Malakai Black. And I look forward to seeing what he can do with Copeland.
JB's next point, are they going to try to make Mercedes Moné more like a heel going into her match against Willow at Double or Nothing, or will they go in with basically a face versus face dynamic? I can't see Willow being effectively framed as a heel, nor do I think that would be a smart move. Where does Chris Statlander factor into all of this? So I think we talked enough about the Mercedes Moné heel, but Chris Statlander, I think there's people expecting her to turn on Willow. Is that the right move, do you think, or do you think it happens?
Wade poised that as an option to me on Wednesday during the Dynamite post-show, and I would prefer that it doesn't happen. I think they have good chemistry together. I think Willow's natural cadence and delivery helps Chris Statlander, who struggles a lot on promos. I also like the pairing with Stokely Hathaway. I like the fact that it came together naturally, and it didn't feel forced. As baby faces, both Chris and Willow should have been weary of Stokely and you know, what he was trying to do and what his intentions were for them. And I like the fact that they've kind of become just affable buddies, and Stokely is, you know, the character that he is, and Chris and Willow sort of put up with him but keep him at arm's length. I like that, and I'd like to see more of it going forward. Tonight was the first time where I looked at the landscape and thought, maybe they're thinking of turning Chris, because when she first got in the ring there to hug Willow with Stokely, she had a real serious look on her face, and I thought they might have been pulling the trigger tonight. And, of course, in reality, she was just setting up for the hug and then leading to Mercedes coming out. But she was in position for an attack from behind.
I know this is going to be an out there thought when it comes to wrestling, but I personally think that baby faces should have friends. And every time they have a friend, we shouldn't necessarily have to discuss, well, is this going to be a turn or what? But it always seems to be the case when a baby face has friends, the discussion ultimately comes down to, well, should they turn them? Will they turn them? That sort of thing. I think it's okay for baby faces to have friends and to not turn on them. I don't know. Maybe that's a radical idea.
Maybe.
JB says, I think we got a hint that Adam Cole's return may come sooner than expected with him getting up and walking from his wheelchair tonight. My question is, if he returns before MJF, what will he do? Will him and MJF return around the same time and resume that feud with no title involved? I mean, they could, you know, you could have him knock off some ring rust in some matches first if he comes back before MJF. But certainly, you know, even if he's ready, it's going to take some time for him to get to or as close to 100% as possible, which is where you would want him when you eventually do that Adam Cole versus MJF match. So I don't really think that's an issue. I think they'll be able to figure that out. And they could always have MJF return when they feel Adam Cole is ready to jump into that match.
Man, I'm curious to see what kind of heat they can get behind MJF and Adam Cole, because I struggle to find a run been more disappointing than Adam Cole in AEW. I'm a huge advocate of Adam Cole. I think he's one of the most talented wrestlers in the world, and it has just been a real deflating experience to watch this Undisputed Kingdom take shape and flounder and get no heat and just kind of exist and float with no real direction or sense of purpose. I mean, Adam Cole standing up from the wheelchair tonight, I mean, cool, I guess, but he is so incredibly damaged, and that faction is dead in the water, has been dead in the water since day one. It stands as one of AEW's biggest mistakes. I mean, it was formed on a night that was universally looked down upon at World's End. It came off the back of the voted worst angle of the year, and they've just done nothing to try to rekindle anything out of it. It's just a lame duck faction with lame duck characters that don't seem to be going anywhere. And I mean, I want to care about an MJF and Adam Cole match, but I don't know if I'm going to, and I don't think the fans are either.
They're a bit of faction fatigue with AEW. Is that partially to blame for this faction not taking hold like AEW may have expected? There are so many factions in AEW. It's, you know, there's a bit of a diminishing returns with them. So is that part of the problem here, or is it just exclusively the way this group has been presented, maybe the way it's been watered down with the inclusion of, some of the other characters here? How much does AEW's overuse of factions, in your opinion, play a part in this group not getting off the ground like they should have?
Well, I think it speaks to the manner in which AEW treats its factions. It's like by the time the Undisputed Kingdom was brought forth, we already had the blueprint for how AEW handles these sorts of things. And it's never been particularly good. I mean, look at a group like the Mogul Embassy, for example, where Swerve Strickland went through a number of different iterations where he was just paired with random undercard talent until they found something that stuck. And then even then, as soon as they wanted to make Swerve Strickland a serious contender for a world championship, they had to move him away from that group because it became very clear from the get-go that this was not a group that had any main event aspirations. You look at something like Bullet Club Gold, now rebranded the Bang Bang Gang, where Jay White has unequivocally been dragged to the depths of the roster just by his association with the Guns and with the Acclaimed and Billy Gunn. I mean, he is another one who has been, harmed greatly by his involvement in factions. They're so loosely defined, and there's so many of them, and they come and go from television at will, it appears. And as a result, none of them feel like they have any meaning or any real strength or really any defining characteristics that separate one from the other. So the Undisputed Kingdom was cut from that same cloth. I mean, even though they were given a dedicated main event storyline, it was one that was seemingly universally disliked. And so they were starting several steps backward, you know, several steps behind right out of the gate. And they've just never been given any sort of opportunity to recover from that.
Back to JB's email. He said, the Fozzie sucks chant wasn't in my bingo card for tonight's show. Are we supposed to feel sympathy for Jericho after that match? The announcer said that the lengths he went to were too far in winning the match, but it was a no DQ match. And we've seen much more extreme ways to win in AEW before. Is the conflicted way Jericho is acting after the match all a ruse? You know, he apologized twice to Hook before hitting the Judas effect and, you know, was conflicted, as JB said, after the match. I don't know. Like, I kind of think it's all a ruse. That's what it's kind of been, or Jericho is delusional as a character. That's kind of what this has been setting up for. So what do you see as AEW's intent in booking the finish and the post-match the way that they did?
I think it's just to get Jericho on TV. I mean, every time he sort of falls out of a major storyline, it seems like he reappears in one out of nowhere, even if it doesn't make a whole lot of sense and the fans don't really seem interested in it. I mean, they took away Judas, which could be a creative ploy by Jericho to turn the crowd. But I think that what he may not have anticipated was that Judas was the only thing keeping him relevant to the audience. I mean, that didn't turn the crowd off from his gimmick. It just took away, I think, the only bit of armor that he had left shielding him from the reality that wrestling has just moved on from Chris Jericho. Mm-hmm. And I think what we saw tonight was a crowd that was speaking its mind and was just sort of fed up with having Jericho matches, 20-minute Jericho matches at that rate, fill time on a 4-hour pay-per-view. I think that he'll make the best of this, and he'll do it in a smart way and one that is advantageous to him. But I mean, if you just go back and look at the rate of successes that Jericho has had with trying to put over younger talent in AEW, it's not a long list. I mean, very rarely do guys come out looking better after having worked with Jericho. And I mean, if they're not careful, Hook is going to fall into that trap as well. I just think that Jericho was absolutely pivotal for the formation of AEW in their first year plus of television. But he seems so much like a relic to that company now and completely unnecessary in a pretty sad way. I mean, I got a kick out of the Fozzie Sucks chant, but the rest of it just seemed, I don't know, like it didn't, It didn't seem like a joke to me. It seemed like they just really don't want to see this guy anymore.
Are you telling me that Action Andretti is not a major superstar in AEW right now after working with Jericho? My goodness.
I don't know. Was he on Rampage?
I think he was.
Well, Rampage
yeah,
is a big show.
A big show. The top three AEW show, you know? So.
Yeah, absolutely.
JB says, I wish AEW would take an indefinite hiatus on using the term dream match, even when it fits the bill, like with Ospreay Danielson tonight, because of overusing the term so much over the last few years. The spot in the Ospreay Danielson match where they waited in both corners to hit their finishing move as the closing sequence and Ospreay won the exchange with the hidden blade was designed masterfully. Was the Danielson injury at work? He sold it incredibly well, but the way the announced team framed it, is Ospreay not realizing it, seemed more like a planned work. Yes, definitely. I think that Ospreay won Danielson's respect with the win tonight, and this is ultimately leading to an Ospreay BCC versus Callis Family Blood and Guts match in the near future. And then JB's last question is, where does Jack Perry fit in with the Bucks and Okada? What is his ceiling in this new role? As always, love the show and go VIP. Thank you, JB. PWTorch.com/goVIP to become a member. So I think, you know, Jack Perry's back. He was hauled off by security tonight, but clearly he is in the good graces of the Young Bucks. Young Bucks have Okada as part. So we had a new faction. Just talking about factions. We had a new faction, Young Bucks, Okada, and now Jack Perry coming in. So how do you see Jack Perry fitting in eventually to this faction that's just been formed?
I think he should be good. I mean, he certainly has gained a good bit of momentum with this suspension and run in New Japan. I think that it's a clever pairing. It makes a lot of sense given what the Young Bucks characters have become. I think that they're going to have to find creative ways to toe the line and prevent it from becoming too self-indulgent and meta, and also to not inadvertently paint Tony Khan as a heel if Jack Perry is getting babyface reactions and is, again, calling himself a scapegoat, which already he has a shirt up on Shop AEW with broken glass that says scapegoat. So they're fully leaning in and committing to that.
And not
gimmick,
only that,
which...
but how do you go with this character while not constantly reminding people of the CM Punk situation, you know, because that's what this entire character was born out of. So I think there's some risk there.
There absolutely is. And they're banking on being able to overcome it. And I guess if you can get through shows without CM Punk chants every week, then job well done. I mean, I guess that's the barometer. I mean, if they've got fans chanting CM Punk every week, then they've got a real issue.
It almost looks like they're setting him up to be the babyface, though, because Jack Perry, who he fought, is a heel. The Young Bucks, who his actions prevented from winning on that show, are heels. So doesn't that inherently paint Punk as the babyface in this situation?
Yeah. Yes, it absolutely does. That's the problem.
That's weird.
That's why they never should have aired any of this to begin with, because then FTR had to come out on Dynamite and cut a promo where they simultaneously dismissed Punk but also agreed with his general sentiment, because they had to remain babyfaces. So they put them in this awful position. And it also undercuts any babyface that Jack Perry is going to wrestle, because that babyface, by having qualms with Jack Perry, is going to be, by proxy, associating themselves with and aligning with CM Punk, who does not work for the company.
Not only does that work for the company, but is a major star in the competition's company,
right?
Which, again,
and has spent an hour plus on a podcast explaining why he doesn't believe the opposition knows how to run a business, and the opposition does all of the things that Punk mentions about not being able to run a business.
Yeah. Interesting times.
It's a wild world. Tony's got the money. Yeah. He can do whatever he wants.
I guess so. That is true. That is true.
If they keep putting shows on like this, does anybody care?
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's kind of what I was thinking about earlier. Like, we're coming at AEW with all these criticisms that I think are valid criticisms, but simultaneously we're saying, at least I'm saying, this was a great show. And like, what did we say about Revolution? It was a great show, pay-per-view of the year. So like, we're these things are existing in the same universe, which I think proves what Punk said. You know, those criticisms are valid. Having a good show and putting on good shows does not inherently correlate necessarily with making money and with being good business. Like, putting on good matches doesn't necessarily correlate with that. So there has to be more to it. I don't know. I was thinking of that earlier, how we're heaping praise upon these shows from a macro point of view, and then from a micro point of view, we're saying, yeah, but. And that's kind of the sentiment that it's been.
I mean, you basically look at it from two different perspectives. I mean, fan me enjoys the show. Usually, you know, for the last few months, enjoys Dynamite with few exceptions, and that's that. I mean, it is what it is. It doesn't make a difference as a fan whether or not this business model is sustainable. I mean, you're watching the shows to enjoy the shows. You hope the company succeeds, but you're not in the business of analyzing that. And from an analyst perspective, you're looking at this and saying, well, yeah, this is great, but also all of these things are working mm-hmm. against you. And so I try very hard to strike a balance. And, you know, I feel for the people who approach it strictly black and white from one side or the other. I mean, the AEW diehards who are not, you know, partaking in just the ridiculous tribalist discourse, like on Twitter and other places, they're just seeing wrestlers that they love having matches that they enjoy and a show that they love that serves as an alternative to WWE. And that's all that's where it ends for them. I mean, it doesn't matter if there's only 2,000 people in the building or if, you know, ratings are dropping consistently and, you know, quarter hours are down after this segment or that segment. Like, that stuff doesn't matter to them. And that's great. Like, for the people who watch the product strictly as a fan, you know, they're getting what they want. So the minutia of this, the gritty details that we talk about, that stuff just doesn't matter. I guess the question is are there enough of those people to sustain this company and carry it long-term into profitability? I mean, to a point where mm-hmm. it's not Tony Khan just basically bankrolling his dream.
Yeah. Yeah, really some existential thinking here tonight on Wrestling Night in America. Let's try one more time with Boris from Chicago. See if he's there. Boris, are you there with us? Hello, Boris. You're on.
No snores this time.
Is that rustling coming from him or from you?
Probably from me.
Oh, I think I got my hopes up. I heard that rustling, and I'm like, he's getting to the phone. He's like, no, it was not. Okay, well, we tried. So anything else? I mean, we got a couple pre-show matches. As a rule, I don't watch pre-shows. I can only stand so much, and I can't stand anymore. So Trent Barretta defeating Matt Sydal, Orange Cassidy and Katsuyori Shibata defeating Shane Taylor and Lee Moriarty, Jay White and the Guns over the Acclaim to unify the AEW Trios and ROH six-man titles. I think we basically hit on all of the all of the other matches. Is there anything else that we didn't spend enough time on that you wanted to mention? Okada and Pac started off the show really hot. Willow and Julia had a short match, surprising. We don't usually see those kind of matches on AEW pay-per-view.
I wonder if that's because Julia.
I know there was
Julia. Is Julia hurt?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
I think Julia
might
be hurt.
Surprised. Yeah, I was surprised because I know she had that match where she hurt, looked like her shoulder or whatever like that, and I was surprised they stuck with this match. Roddy Strong versus Kyle O'Reilly, I really like the match. I disagree. I know Sean, I think, felt this way. I know Zach Haydorn felt this way, that the match did not belong on pay-per-view. I disagree. I think their history as two wrestlers who have long been associated with each other, going against each other for really the first time in a long time, certainly in AEW, combined with the fact that Roderick Strong has been a major presence on TV, I thought combined to make this a pay-per-view worthy match. Now you can argue, you know, about the length of the show, and you can argue about the number of matches on the show, but I mean, this is what AEW is. Like, I mean, we could have that argument every month. I'm really not interested in constantly having that argument because it is what it is. And AEW has found that this is the best way to go. And Tony Khan prefers the shows this way. He's been asked every way but sideways about the length of pay-per-views in history, and he has not backed down from it. He hears the criticisms, and we're still getting shows that go to midnight. So it is what it is. I'm not going to litigate that every month. So all of that being said, I thought Strong versus Kyle O'Reilly was really good, very hard hitting.
Yeah, I understand the sentiment from both Sean and Zach, and generally speaking, I agree with it. I think that given the opportunity, my argument is always going to be in favor of a tighter show with fewer matches, because I think that the impact of the matches that you do have will be greater felt than they are if you try to absolutely just load the card, pack it to the gills the way that AEW often does. And yes, if you were going to pare down this card, this is one of the matches that I think would get the cut. However, like you said, Greg, knowing what AEW is and knowing what AEW does, they are going to deliver a four-hour pay-per-view, no matter what. That is what they do. They have proven it time and time and time and time again. And with that in mind, with that context in mind, I thought this was very good. I liked the psychology of it. I thought that Roddy going to the backbreaker repeatedly to try to wear Kyle out was really, really good. I thought the announcers told the story of it effectively. Kyle looked like the strong underdog babyface. I think the only knock I would have on the match, if I were to criticize a little bit, would be the finish came a little abruptly for me. I thought that Wardlow getting involved and then kind of getting removed from the apron and then they just do a clean finish anyway felt a little off, but minor complaint, no big deal. I think just for the sake of, you know, owing to the idea that this is going to be a four-hour show, would I have still shaved a few minutes off of this one to give some breath between Ospreay and Danielson? Yes, definitely. But other than that, yeah, I thought it was good.
All right, Brandon, I think that'll do it for us tonight. Any final words about AEW Dynasty before we turn the page and start talking the WWE draft next week?
Another very good show. AEW is very, very good at these pay-per-views. We've said that for a long time now. Tonight is no different. It doesn't excuse the many criticisms I have of the product overall, but they know how to sell a pay-per-view, or not sell a pay-per-view, but deliver a pay-per-view. And they did that again tonight. So yeah, next time I join you, it will be Backlash in France. We got a Saturday afternoon.
Yes. Yes. Just to clarify, Backlash will be in France. We won't. We'll be here wherever we are right now.
I am very French. I am very French. However, I will not be
Leclerc.
Nor have I ever.
Oui, oui. All right, Brandon. Thanks so much. You can check out Brandon's alternative perspective report of AEW Dynasty, as well as a bunch of other stuff, Brandon. I'm sure you can list them better than I can. So let fans know what you do for the Torch each and every week.
Sure. Yeah, I cover AEW pay-per-views and WWE premium live events for PW Torch. You can find my alt perspective reporting for each of those events on the VIP side as well as the free side. I also join Greg for Wrestling Night in America after each of those events, and then occasionally on the post shows with Wade Keller as well.
Awesome. Well, we'll talk to you in 2 weeks, Brandon. Thanks for stopping by tonight.
Sounds good.
And thank all of you for stopping by. We, on non-pay-per-view evenings, are live at 8 p.m. Eastern on pwtorchdailycast.com with Wrestling Night in America, where I'm joined by a co-host, usually from the Torch family, to talk the big shows in pro wrestling. That's what we do here. And so you can join us 8 p.m. Eastern next Sunday night, previewing WWE Backlash, the next major event to happen. And as Brandon and I talked about, we will be talking to you live after Backlash, same style as we do here, taking your phone calls and emails. So we'll talk to you then. You can find me on social media at Greg M. Parks. You can find my full page column each and every week in the Torch newsletter, as well as my VIP audio show, Greg Parks Out Loud. Until next week, if it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America.